Starship, Take 3, and the women who paved the way for future female astronauts. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. SpaceX is preparing to launch its Starship rocket once again after two attempts ended in explosions. The company is targeting a third launch later this week. NASA plans to use the vehicle to land astronauts on the moon. We'll speak with podcast host Anthony Colangelo about the stakes for this test. Then, 13 women changed the future of space exploration for female astronauts back in the 1960s. We'll revisit a conversation with author Rebecca Siegel about her book To Fly Among the Stars, The Hidden Story of the Fight for Women Astronauts. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? SpaceX is gearing up for another test flight of its massive Starship rocket. After two attempts that ended in explosions, SpaceX is moving forward with an ambitious third test mission as early as Thursday. Starship will take NASA astronauts to the lunar surface, but it's not the only lunar-bound vehicle making headlines these days. Here to talk about the buzz in commercial moon news is Anthony Colangelo, host of the space podcast Main Engine Cutoff. Anthony, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be back, man. I always enjoy coming out and hanging out with you here.
Yeah, there's always something fun to talk about when you're on the show, including another attempt at launching Starship. Tell us a bit about our expectations for SpaceX's test launch this week.
I hate to say it, but they're pretty high. they really set the bar pretty high with the last one, which they've since closed out the investigation into what happened in the second launch. And part of that finding was that the upper stage of that second launch was just about to its final destination on the trajectory they had sketched out. And because of the nature of the test, they had to have a bit extra propellant on board the upper stage to fly the way that they needed to, but they didn't actually need all that propellant for the reentry. So they were going for a process where they would vent out the unneeded propellant. And when they did that, they triggered some fires that triggered some loss of communications to the vehicle, and it then triggered its autonomous flight termination system, which destroyed the vehicle. So they failed on that launch because they needed to vent propellant that they didn't actually need for the next part of the mission. So it's a little bit of a bummer that that happened. But what that means is, you know, everything up to that point went really, really well. And they should be able to repeat that and fly to that same spot and hopefully go further this time and actually make it around the world. The trajectory is a little bit different. So maybe we can talk about some of the differences with this flight, because I do find it some notable changes that should impact the way that we think about the way they're going about the Starship testing from flight three and beyond.
I do want to talk about that, but let's stay on the kind of investigation here. You mentioned that it's because they had all this extra fuel and that was particularly the issue. But like, something that I often forget about SpaceX is that this is how they work, and every iteration after these things is usually largely successful. I mean, that's the whole point of the reason that they test this way, right, is to learn about this. Can you explain a bit about like SpaceX's mantra of blowing stuff up and then learning so much about it?
You know, they bias towards tests and towards action and towards events rather than biasing towards analysis, which in the past couple of years, I think we've seen some good examples of the difference of these things, right? We've seen SLS fly, we've seen Vulcan Centaur fly from United Launch Alliance, both vehicles that really went out of their way to explain the fact that we're going to analyze this thing until we're ready to fly it. And for most purposes, you would say that those first two flight tests of those vehicles went flawlessly. SpaceX has always operated in the other direction, where they're going to fly the thing they have ready now and test some of their hypothesis that they have as they continue to make progress. And what they do is they jump forward in their timeline, really, because they discover, actually, what we needed to do was not that hardware change. We need to shift to this other methodology because we discovered something in the process of flying, refined our thinking about what we actually need to build. So it isn't necessarily that they're continuing to test up to the predefined design decisions that they made. They're really testing every single decision that they make along the way and reconsidering whether that was a thing that they should have had in the design or not. So they're not only like different ways of getting to your final result, they're actually fundamentally different work patterns where SpaceX doesn't actually know what the final iteration of Starship will look like right now. They're finding that out as they fly. They never actually knew what the final iteration of Falcon 9 was until they got there. They thought they were going to recover that first stage with some parachutes back in the day. And then eventually they realized maybe we should use the engines that we brought with us. And here we are. They've landed 200 and some Falcon 9 cores in a row. And we kind of all just assume like that's the way that SpaceX has always been and they're always going to go about it. But they only got there by way of testing the decisions that they made and rethinking them constantly.
Let's talk about this upcoming mission. This is the third orbital test flight attempt. You said it's in an interesting trajectory. What is it, and what does that tell us about this mission?
So it's actually exactly in line with what I was just talking about. They're going to be taking an approach, at least this is what I glean from what they've posted about this mission so far, that looks a lot more like the Falcon 9 development pattern than what Starship seemed like before that. So till now, they were doing a test flight that was going to test the next technological thing they needed to understand. So in the, you know, they were doing suborbital flights to determine, could we do this crazy flip maneuver at the end and stick the landing? They finally did that. They said, great, onward to orbital testing. Can we launch this giant booster off of this launch pad in Texas? Well, first time they did launch it, but it blew up the test pad, the launch pad, so they had to rethink that. Next time, could we do hot staging? So they're going to turn on the upper stage engines before they separate the booster. Does that work? All right, that works. And they were working through their tech tree, but it kind of seemed like they were still a few steps away before they'd be able to do actual payload missions with Starship or any of the refueling tests that they needed to do to fly out the Artemis manifest. With this third flight, they're going to be doing a couple of tests on board the vehicle once they're in space that indicate to me that they are going to start flying payload missions as soon as they possibly can on Starship rather than once they've checked off a number of technical boxes. The trajectory is a little bit different in that the first two flights were intended to fly almost all the way around the Earth, and they would re-enter over near Hawaii, and there would be some imaging happening there as they underwent re-entry. This time, they are targeting the southern Indian Ocean, and they say that's because they're going to be doing some tests of the Raptor engine in space. They want to fire the engine up in space. The way it reads is that they have a little bit more margin that if something goes wrong, they are not going to hit a populated area, so that there's more margin for error. Before that, though, there's some other, well, I guess technically in the timeline, it's after the engine firing that this will happen. They're going to test opening and closing payload doors on the vehicle. They're going to test transferring propellant within the vehicle between different tanks. And those are the two missions that Starship will fly until, you know, humans go to the moon. They're going to be flying payloads like Starlink, all the satellites that SpaceX builds internally. They're going to be flying propellant tankers to fuel up a tanker that will then eventually take the Artemis astronauts and their lander out to the moon. Being able to work towards those objectives means that from this point forward, you know, if flight three goes well, maybe there's another flight four or five. At some point in the very near future, maybe this year, they'll start doing these test missions where they have a whole stack of Starlinks on board. And Falcon 9, you know, they were testing the re-entry and landing of Falcon 9 boosters by flying a payload. And then that first stage job was done and they can go do a test to try to land on the ocean and then land on a boat and then land at land. But they were always able to do that as an active mission. This seems to indicate that they're going to do that same thing with Starship. Fly a whole stack of Starlinks. Let's test the re-entry on the way back in. We're probably going to lose a lot of these Starships on the way back in, but at least they got hundreds of satellites up on orbit. So they're able to take that same methodology of testing things as they actually do active flights that matter for their overall manifest.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Anthony Colangelo. He's the host of the Main Engine Cutoff podcast. We're talking about Starship's test flight later this week. Anthony, what I gathered from what you talked there is a lot at stake for this test mission, right? Not only you mentioned that Starship is going to be for the Artemis missions taking humans to the moon, but SpaceX is relying a lot on this infrastructure for its payloads and getting things into space. And as you mentioned, this test is going to be looking a lot at the payload capabilities of this. What is at stake for SpaceX with this mission? And does it have to go well for them?
It's a big stakes kind of thing because it's a huge visibility event. But does this particular flight need to go well or else? Not really. Like, I think they need to get Starlinks flying on Starship in the very near future. Because where they're at with Starlink is that they have iterated to a version 2 of their Starlink satellite payload. But now they're kind of at this interim step where they call V2 Mini. They're able to fly a lot of the V2 technology on a smaller satellite on Falcon 9, but that isn't as good as flying the full-on V2 satellite that only fits on Starship. So in a lot of ways, they've hinged the future technologically of Starlink to the size of Starship. A lot of the interest right now in increasing bandwidth, obviously, with Starlink to be able to have more customers on the same satellites. But also there's this whole burgeoning industry of direct-to-cell satellite technology. So instead of connecting to a cell tower, you would be able to connect to one of these satellites without a special phone. This is anyone's cell phone. As long as that cell provider has a deal with one of these satellite networks, would be able to carry text, data. In some cases, I've heard that there are some tests out there with other competitors actually doing voice and video through these satellites as well. So it seems like this is going to be a really big thing for the satellite industry in the next 5 or 10 years. That is an area that SpaceX sees as huge growth for Starlink. But again, they want to fly satellites that are big and those only fit on Starship because Starship is absolutely enormous.
Switching gears just a bit, Anthony, I want to talk a bit about some other moon missions, including the Eclipse mission. You spoke with the co-founder and CTO of Intuitive Machines on your podcast earlier this month. As we know, Intuitive Machines made it to the moon, landed on the moon, but the payload toppled over. What did we learn about this mission? And what are people like Tim Crane saying about the success of that first attempt?
It was a huge success when you look at, you know, overall their trajectory, right? They were able to land a payload softly on the moon. Did it stay perfectly intact? No, but I'm not counting score over here for a lot of people, but that one looks a lot more successful than a lot of things that have crashed in the moon in the last 10 years. So I'm giving them at least most credit for that mission. All in all, to fly a piece of hardware on your first attempt, fly it out to the moon, have so many things go wrong. There was just stuff constantly going wrong with this mission, but still be able to stick the landing to some extent and actually have payloads operating on the lunar surface, get some experience operating in that environment. Well, it was a huge success. And this was a landing that was 80 degrees south on the moon, so very, very southerly. And that environment is weird. There's very little Earth visible above the horizon. It's barely over the horizon. So in terms of communications, there's a lot there that doesn't work like you'd expect it. You're bouncing signals off the lunar surface the whole time because you're aiming at Earth. So there's a lot of weird stuff that happens down there. So the fact that they're able to do this mission and really understand what things held up, what things didn't, they can redesign for their next lander. And that's just a huge boost to their overall progress. Intuitive Machines is interesting because they're one of the only competitors that has multiple missions already signed on with the same lander, I should say. So Intuitive Machines has this base lander, Nova C. They have three missions slated to go. Astrobotic, on the other hand, flew Peregrine, but the next lander is something called Griffin. It's mostly different, right? So there's a lot more that Intuitive Machines can learn from this mission and apply immediately to their next mission in a few months that then Astrobotic is going to be able to take hardware-wise from Peregrine and apply to Griffin that's coming up, hopefully this year, but probably next year.
And these missions part of NASA's Commercial Lunar Payload Service Program, CLPS, which I know you were telling me beforehand you're kind of obsessed with. what does this mean, like, now that we've had these two landers? What is, from your vantage point, what is the outlook of the future of this program and the future of these missions?
I honestly still think it's out for debate, and that's why I'm so obsessed with it, because it is weird, right? A lot of people equate this to what we've seen out of Florida with commercial cargo and crew, where NASA chose SpaceX and Boeing on the crew side, and SpaceX and now Northrop Grumman on the cargo side, and Sierra Nevada as well, where they picked providers to develop vehicles for a particular purpose. And NASA not only funded the development of those vehicles, but they also bought a whole slate of missions before they were even flying. So these companies had an assurance that the huge investment, and it was a huge investment from all these companies, in many cases, they lost money on these deals. They knew that there was a future to the program. Eclipse environment is different. NASA only funds the individual missions themselves. So you win a task order or you don't. There is no development money for Intuitive Machines. There is just the money that they got from these task orders. So that means the companies have to be figuring out either other customers that will fly on board these landers. Maybe they have to figure out other funding mechanisms altogether to get through their development phase. And then the other aspect is there are, you know, I forget the exact number of how many task orders have been awarded right now. It's less than 10, and it's across many different providers. So there's 5, 6, 7 competitors in this CLPS environment that over the next 10 years will fly their first mission to the moon. And as we know, most first missions to the moon end up not at the moon intact. So for NASA, there's a whole gauntlet to jump here where all of these providers have to get their first flight, you know, on the surface. And that might take 2 or 3 tries. And NASA has to be able to weather that storm programmatically to be able to continually go out in front of public and have press conferences like we saw with Astrobotic, which is, we're not going to make the moon this time, but this is the reason that we have this program. We want to take these shots on goal approaches. While at the same time, you might have a company like Intuitive Machines get really good at this. So there's a really strange divergence here that, to me, somebody who analyzes the structure of these programs, makes me go like, maybe they should have done the commercial cargo approach where they're picking two providers and funding a long string of missions, but there was never going to be a budget line for that from Congress. And the logjam that is CLPS is what I'm so mystified by, is that I really enjoy that this is a program that exists because it's interesting and it's NASA doing something that they haven't really done before in this way. It's kind of more akin to what the Department of Defense in the US does with small launch providers, where they buy task orders from these rockets that may or may not exist. If it works out, great. If it doesn't work out, then we'll just find the ones that exist and fly on those. So it's more in that vein, but NASA doesn't really do that. This is why I'm trying to paint why I'm obsessed with this, because it's just one of the most interesting storylines going on in space these days.
It really is. And if you'd like to find out more about it, be sure to tune into Anthony's podcast, Main Engine Cutoff, which is opinion analysis of spaceflight exploration policy and strategy. You can get it at mainenginecutoff.com or wherever you get this podcast. Anthony, we'll have to have you back on to talk more about CLIPS, because it is really fascinating and you've raised some really, really interesting questions. So let's talk more, and thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Still to come, the fight for female astronauts. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. This Women's History Month, we are revisiting a conversation with author Rebecca Siegel about her book, To Fly Among the Stars, The Hidden Story of the Fight for Women Astronauts. The book profiles the 13 women who trained alongside NASA's original Mercury 7 astronauts in the 1960s, and although they didn't make it into space, they paved the way for future female astronauts. Here's that conversation with Siegel, which first aired in April 2020.
It is a fantastic story. Can you kind of like tell us a bit about these women? Who were they? When women weren't in aviation through the military, they still somehow found themselves in planes and then found themselves in this program. How did they get there?
So the 13 women in this book were all pilots. Most of them were career pilots. Some of them were hobbyists, but they came from a variety of backgrounds. Most were middle class, you know, who worked hard to afford their flight lessons. Some were quite poor. And one, Janie Hart, she was the wife of Phil Hart, the senator from Michigan. She was really wealthy. But they all had this thing in common, which was that they were all in love with flying airplanes. And that's saying something, because in the 50s and 60s, getting into an airplane at all for anybody, man or woman, was tricky. But getting into an airplane for a woman meant overcoming all kinds of obstacles. Not only did they have to be able to afford their flight lessons and find a flight instructor who would teach them, but they also had to get past this notion that flying was a man's job or something that was only appropriate for men. And what's interesting is looking at this group of different women who were different ages. You know, the youngest was 22 and the oldest was 39, you know, and they lived all over the United States doing all different kinds of jobs. But they had this common thread between them, which was that they were all quite ambitious, very driven, brave, patriotic. And in those first years of the space race, they were all really captivated by that idea that maybe if they were good enough pilots, they might be able to become astronauts as well. And that's something that, you know, they had in common with the Mercury 7, who I'm sure your listeners will know, these guys, John Glenn, Alan Shepard, Scott Carpenter, you know, these aviators who tested to become astronauts and went through this really grueling, invasive process in order to become our first space pilots. They also had those same personality traits where they were just driven, independent, very smart, and very hopeful about their future in astronautics.
The book kind of parallels them as it moves forward, and you get to see what the Mercury 7 were doing in comparison to what the women were doing, and a lot of the testing was similar, and I found that aspect of the book to be the most fascinating is these tests that they performed on these 13 women, and then the fact that that evidence is just gone now, right? I mean, what happened with, first of all, talk about these tests, and then, you know, this quest of you trying to track down these tests, and it's not there anymore. What happened to it?
Just to back up a little bit. So at the very beginning of this process, you know, it's the first years at NASA, and NASA's astronaut selection committee needs to find the best people to fly in space, which we didn't know very much about what spaceflight would do to human body at the time. So really what that meant was, let's get somebody really smart, physically fit, have good mental health, and have proven themselves in these situations that are similar to what we think spaceflight will be like. And ultimately that meant finding pilots who were healthy, young, and were able to handle stress well. And so in order to find those people, NASA was putting these guys through these really intense tests. They were a series of medical, psychological, and stress adaptability tests. And they tested everything about them. You know, they tested their hearts, their lungs, the contents of their stomachs. They tested their vision, their hearing, their adaptability to vertigo. So one of the tests that they did was inject supercooled liquid into their inner ear to freeze the bones inside their ear, which induces vertigo. And then what the doctors would do is then they would stand back and time these pilots to see how fast they could recover. And then they had to do the whole test on the other ear, which sounds even worse because you would know what was coming. But what's interesting is that about a year after the Mercury 7 underwent these tests, this group of women began undergoing their own privately funded version of those same tests, and they were performing well. However, we don't know exactly how well they performed because we don't know where their test results went. For the most part, there's some data from one of their tests. It was this bicycle test that they had to ride a bike against an increased incline to see how they could perform. And on that test, we know that the women performed about on par with the men. However, the rest of the tests are gone. The test results are gone. And I think even the fact that they're lost reflects the cultural attitude of the time. You know, the fact that we don't know where those tests went shows that people were not taking this women astronaut testing program seriously. If you spend any time in space history communities, people are always showing the pictures that they have of their dad and John Glenn. And these things have become these treasures of American history. And the fact that a big stack of papers from the Loveless Medical Clinic in Albuquerque, New Mexico, which was the place where these men and women underwent their medical testing, the fact that that data is gone just shows how dismissive people were of this entire project.
The argument that was made by advocates to put women into the astronaut corps was that, you know, they were physically fitter, but more importantly, they were smaller, they ate less, they breathed less, which is important when you're packing a capsule for survival, which they argued made them good candidates for these first flights. Where was the pushback on having women in the astronaut corps at NASA? What was their reasoning why they couldn't be a part of this program?
Sure. Well, the short answer is that women were not selected for those Mercury flights because women were never seriously considered for those Mercury flights. The testing program that these women underwent was not done through NASA. It was a privately funded research program conducted by this guy named Dr. Lovelace. He was a chairman of NASA's Committee on Life Sciences at the time, but his research project was separate from NASA. But beyond that, these women weren't chosen to become astronauts because people at NASA weren't thinking about women at NASA as astronauts yet.
And in their quest to remedy that, some of these women even went to Congress, right? I mean, how did that go?
In the summer of 1962, two of the women, Jerry Cobb and Janie Hart, took their fight to Washington, D.C. in a special hearing in the House of Representatives, where they basically argued that NASA's astronaut requirements, which remember were that astronauts to be military test pilots with jet flight experience, and these were two things that women simply could not achieve. And so Cobb and Hart went to Congress arguing that NASA was discriminating against women by having those astronaut requirements. Like, they were saying this is gender discriminatory because 50% of the population cannot meet the qualifications that this agency has set out. At face value, I think that this hearing looked like it was going to be good for the women because they were getting attention. People were listening to their concerns. They were taking it seriously enough to have a hearing in the House of Representatives, but it was a total flop. Jerry Cobb testified talking about why women should be considered as viable astronaut candidates. And Janie Hart gave this amazing testimony where she argued basically that while it's fine for women who want to be homemakers and who want to stay home with their children, she said it's also fine that for some women, the PTA is not enough. She was basically saying, we are entering into this new phase in American culture where women are leaving the house and these career doors need to be open for them. So after these two women, both of them were astronaut test subjects, gave their testimonies, then this woman named Jackie Cochran walks in and she is going to give her testimony. And so a little background on Cochran, she had actually funded the women's astronaut testing program. She was a really wealthy woman. She was a famous aviator. She owned a cosmetics empire. She was this dynamo. You know, Americans knew about her. But somewhere along the line, she had decided that she changed her mind. She no longer supported this women's astronaut testing program. And there's some suggestion that the reason she was no longer supporting it was because she had been excluded from it. So she was in her 50s, which was too old to become an astronaut by these guidelines. And there's some evidence that maybe she was mad that she wasn't included in this process. But she argued in the House of Representatives that she didn't support this program. She thought it was too small, too limited. The results were not going to accurately reflect a whole gender. And so what she did is she presented NASA with this sort of attractive argument, which was basically saying, we're not going to accept women astronauts right now, but we will later in the future after we've done a lot more work. And that sort of bought the agency some wiggle room to say, oh, we're not against women. We're just not going to take any at the moment. And that let NASA proceed with Gemini and Apollo. Now, at the end of this trial, John Glenn and Scott Carpenter both testified, and they both argued that no, NASA wasn't discriminating against women, that to be an astronaut, you did need to be a test pilot and you did need to have jet flight experience. And this is where John Glenn said this really famous line, which was men go off and fly the airplanes and fight the wars. And basically he said the fact that women are not in this field is a fact of our social order. He wasn't justifying the discrimination against women, but he was sort of explaining it. Like, okay, the fact that women can't be astronauts isn't something we should be arguing with. It's just how the world is. And I think for these women, that was what they were up against. You know, this notion that the world has some spheres that are appropriate for men and some that are appropriate for women. And these women just weren't ready to accept that.
How did their work kind of change the, as you write in the book, the trajectory of the American space program? What effects did their fight have getting the gender politics out of spaceflight, if it had any effect at all?
You know, I would like to say that all their hard work paid off and they all went into space. But, you know, none of the women in the Mercury 13 made it to space. And in fact, we didn't get women astronaut candidates until 1978. And then beyond that, a woman didn't pilot a spacecraft until Eileen Collins did it in 1995. So it was a long, long road to get women aviators into the positions they wanted in American spaceflight. But that's not to say that these women didn't have an impact on the way the American crewed spaceflight developed. But there was a lag, a big lag. So this all wrapped up right around 1963, and it was 15 years before we saw women being welcomed into the astronaut corps. And even then, they weren't pilots. They were mission specialists. They were scientists, you know, researchers. And that was great. That was a huge leap forward, but that wasn't what these women, these original pilots, had wanted. These women wanted to see a woman fly a spacecraft. And, you know, in 1995, when Eileen Collins did, she piloted the space shuttle, several of these women were there for the launch, and they were able to finally see their work pay off.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or even on YouTube these days, or really wherever you get your podcasts. We've got more space coverage online. Visit wmfe.org/space. Are We There Yet? This is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our intern is Emily Ching. Editorial guidance comes from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.